Welcome to Your True North, a program that explores how values act as a compass, directing our lives and work. Inspiring guests tell how key events and influential figures shaped their values and how they've used those values to create a life rich in meaning, accomplishments, and personal satisfaction. Your True North is hosted by Cindy Camp. Are you seeking your true north? Then welcome.
Welcome to Your True North, a show that explores how values act as a compass for life's journey. I'm your host, Cindy Camp, and today I will be talking with Forrest Perry, an associate professor of philosophy at St. Xavier University in Chicago. He earned his doctorate at Vanderbilt University, where he also worked in the Center for Teaching, the Writing Studio, and the Center for Ethics. It's my pleasure to welcome you today, Forrest, and I'd like to start out by asking you about your childhood. If you'd tell us a little bit about where you grew up.
I grew up in a small city or suburb, about maybe a 30-minute drive outside of Portland, Oregon. I grew up wealthy and white. So when I say wealthy, I don't mean the wealthiest 0.1%. That's kind of the fabulously wealthy. But my guess is my parents were somewhere in the top 2-3%. And that definitely had an influence on my life. And I'm more than happy to talk more about that. In terms of growing up white, one indication of that is I think in my graduating class of upwards of 300 students, there were maybe two or three students who were African American. There certainly were other people of color in my graduating class, but I remember hearing from a friend many, many years after graduating from high school that the city next to Westland, Lake Oswego, was sometimes referred to as Lake No Negro. I mean, that's how white Lake Oswego was and West Lynn as well. But yeah, my father was a chief financial officer, a CFO for a middleman metal distributor. And my mother, she was a stay-at-home mom for much of the period when I was growing up, but she had been a home economics teacher.
Well, that's interesting to hear you reflect on sort of the location of your childhood, the physical place in terms of its economic and also its social makeup. I'm curious if you're thinking back to being a child and now as an adult, how growing up in an affluent family has affected you.
Yeah, I mean, I've certainly had occasion to think about that. A lot of the impact or influence is felt at a kind of subconscious or even unconscious level. And I mean, I'm doing a great disservice to my parents by just focusing on these particular things. Sorry, Mom and Dad. But one of the things that kind of ended up having a subtle influence on me as I was growing up, I guess I grew up to be very brand conscious, very conscious of what I was wearing. I think one indication of how this ended up impacting my older brother is he didn't want to wear certain clothes if they came from a certain store. And my mom, every once in a while, would find a shirt or something that she really liked and thought he would like, and she would put it in a Nordstrom's bag before putting it on his bed, so in the hope of deceiving him. I mean, I myself was also influenced by this. I mean, I liked to wear Polo Ralph Lauren clothing. When my mother would go to the little Polo Ralph Lauren area of the Nordstrom store, she was known on a first name basis. And I remember there was this one sweater, I think it was originally my older brother's, but I think it was $220. And this was back in like 1991, 92. And I didn't like wearing the sweater because it was wool, and I would wear a t-shirt and then the wool sweater on top, and it was uncomfortable and I would sweat, but I'd wear it because when I would go to school, down the left-hand side, it said Polo USA. And another way of reading that is $220, like down. And that was a deal, actually. I think my mom got a good deal on it because she was able to find a hole in the sweater. And I guess one of the ways that influenced me in a kind of subtle, unconscious way, I remember when I was a junior in high school, I was with my girlfriend at the time, and we were at the mall, and she did not come from an affluent family. And she grew up in the same city, but not her parents did not have the wealth my parents did. And she wanted to go into this shoe store called Volume Shoe Source. And there was something visceral. I was mortified. The thought of going into that store was embarrassing to me.
Because it was more of a bargain sort of a store? Or?
Yeah, it's like, there's no way I can be seen in that store. There's no way. And I did not go into that store with her. And when she came, I forget whether she came out with a bag that said Volume Shoe Source. I don't quite remember that. What I do know is that if she had come out with a bag, I would have insisted in taking the contents of what was in that bag and putting them in one of our other bags and discarding the Volume Shoe Source. So that's, yeah, that ended up having a strange kind of effect on me.
Yeah, and I'm sure most teenagers today would have some brand awareness, and certainly some brands are more popular than others. But as you're making clear, the sort of wealthy world in which you were raised, your personal family and the community in which you grew up gave you access to brands that most teenagers aren't able to afford.
Yeah, yeah.
So it sounds like you were very conscious of those kinds of things. Now, as an adult, how does coming from that affluent family affect you now, whether in your thinking, in your lifestyle?
Well, I still only wear Polo Ralph Lauren. No, just kidding. I think that one of the things living that life enabled me to understand is that so much of what people buy is governed by a concern for status. Certainly not everything, but and this ended up being something that I looked into for my dissertation, the extent to which consumption patterns are determined by a concern for social status. And so you have, for instance, Juliet Shore's book, The Overspent American, that makes this argument. You also have the French thinker, sometimes described as an anthropologist, sociologist, philosopher, Pierre Bourdieu. He has this large book called Distinction, where he talks about not just the clothing you might purchase might be governed by a concern for status, but also the food that you eat and how you eat shows where you come from. So I learned growing up, I remember my mother would always comment on my best friend's table manners. Oh, he has such great table manners. So I learned that having good table manners was important. I eventually learned that you want to make sure you use the right fork. You want to make sure that if there's a piece of bread in front of you, you break it up into quarters. You never just take that thing and just start chewing on it and then set it back down. Those types of things, Pierre Bourdieu points out, are reflective of one's social position. And they're the types of things that they become second nature. To use Bourdieu's term, they become part of one's habitus, this kind of habitual way of being oriented in the world. And so it's stuff that's, yeah, you have to, I think, read books like Juliet Shore's The Overspent American to start to see the extent to which we're worried about our social position, and understandably so in a world or in a country that is characterized by so much economic inequality.
Are there any other ways in which that affluence has affected your life as an adult?
One thing I can say is that pretty much at no point in my life have I had to worry about money, really worry about money. I've always known that if something went wrong, I could borrow money from my parents. I had my entire college education paid for by my parents, and that's an education that cost well over $100,000. I don't live with college debt. They bought me my first car. They helped me make a down payment on my first house in Nashville, Tennessee, when I was a graduate student. So here I am, a graduate student, and I own a house. And then when I moved to Chicago, the money from the proceeds of the sale of the Nashville house weren't enough to buy a decent house here, so I got yet another more help. So I've gotten all this assistance, and I try to remain aware of that, because there have been times when occasionally I've thought, oh, I have to worry about my money here, or what if I lose my job, or something like that. And at those times, I get these glimpses, mere glimpses, into what it must be like to be economically insecure. And it's a terrible feeling. Again, I'm not suggesting that I've experienced it to the extent that way too many Americans, way too many people in this world have experienced it. But yeah, if for no fault of your own you end up unemployed, if for no fault of your own you end up having your house foreclosed on or something like that, I mean, it's a bad thing to go through. And I haven't had to go through it.
Great. And now I'd like to ask you a bit about your professional accomplishments. Would you tell us in some detail about the work that you do as a university professor in a philosophy department?
Yeah, I see myself first and foremost as an educator, as a teacher. I don't see myself first and foremost as a scholar. I think that scholarship is definitely very important for making sure that the teaching one does is current and engaged in the types of issues that are being discussed at the time.
Yeah, and you know, as you're talking about this, and I know this program is focused on the topic of values or guiding principles, whatever we want to call them, as an educator and your work as a philosophy professor, I know one of your objectives is to get your students to think critically. So I'm wondering about any other core values. It certainly sounds like thinking for oneself would be a big one for you.
Yeah, I mean, I hope that what I do in the classroom makes the world a better place. I'm not confident that it does, but I'm definitely hopeful. And it will sound, I guess, kind of like a cliche, but what it is that I'm hoping to instill in my students, among other things, is the capacity to think critically. So we hear this term all the time. Mm-hmm. And I've over the years, I've kind of fastened upon a certain understanding of critical thinking. And I've taken it from this guy by the name of Stephen Brookfield. He says that critical thinking has two central activities. The first is identifying and challenging assumptions. And the second is exploring alternative ways of thinking and acting. And identifying and challenging one's own assumptions, that's obviously not easy to do. Mm-hmm. And so I guess as an educator, I have the advantage of having students who are kind of they're required to do the work that I assign that would get them to do that. And when it comes to exploring alternative ways of thinking and acting, I'm particularly interested in exploring ways of thinking and acting that have been suppressed in U.S. history. And what for so long I've found fascinating, and my students seem to respond pretty well to, at least the students here at St. Xavier. There was a different response when I taught students at Vanderbilt. But what I find fascinating and that my students seem to be engaged in when it comes to challenging certain dominant ways of thinking, it's those ways of thinking associated with capitalism.
So could you say a little bit about what it is in capitalism that you really object to and what it is about socialism that is something you would identify with?
I mean, a slogan that I find useful that captures what's problematic about capitalism is profits over people. So a capitalist system is one in which companies are required, if they want to survive, required to engage in profit making, at least enough to continue to grow so that they can beat out potential competitors. And it just seems that if we have so many crucial issues that need to be solved, whether it be poverty or inequality, racism, the destruction of the natural environment, why rig the system against caring about anything except profit making? Now, if you could show me that profit making is going to generate solutions to those various issues and problems that I just listed, great. There are people who make that argument. I don't find that or those arguments particularly convincing. So, yeah, this idea of profits over people is problematic. And capitalism is also a system in which a small minority of people are making a lot of the decisions about how we are going to put to use the means of production. So you cannot live, you cannot have for yourself the means of life, the means of subsistence, unless you have two things, means of production and what Marx calls labor power, which he, by which he means just the capacity to labor. You need those two things. Those are two inputs, labor power and means of production, in order to produce the things that we need in order to subsist and ideally live comfortable lives. And the society we have separates those two things. It's a class-divided society, which means labor power is controlled to some extent by the vast majority of people who have their capacity to labor that they can sell in exchange for a wage. And then you've got this small minority of people who own the means of production. And they themselves are having to be attentive to, having to obey what's called the capitalist imperative, the imperative or the demand or the command to engage in profit making. And so another way of, I guess, saying what the problem is with that class division and that small minority of people being in control of decision making about the what to do with the means of production is that it's you don't have democracy. So we talk so much in the United States about how valuable democracy is. The places in which the vast majority of adults spend the bulk of their waking lives are authoritarian structures where people do not participate in the decisions about how to put to use the means of production. And so they get used to not participating in discussions about important issues. And I'm guilty of that as well. I mean, I talk a lot about the importance of engaging in democratic decision making, but I myself don't have a great deal of experience in doing that.
And is that the heart of socialism from your point of view, is that more people are involved in the decision making, more people have a sort of stake in how an economy, how a society is structured and how resources are used?
Yeah, if I'm focusing primarily on the economic dimension of society, then I would say that what is crucial for that the essential element of socialism is that people are participating in making decisions about how the means of production are used specifically. So Bernie Sanders, I mean, it's great, I think, that he got the traction he did. I think it's great that we finally were able to, or that people were finally able to show the mainstream media that saying you're a socialist doesn't necessarily doom you. But to my knowledge, Bernie Sanders never once talked about the means of production. And for me, that's, you can't talk about socialism without talking about the means of production, all the instruments, all the machinery, all the raw materials, all the stuff that goes into producing things. You have to talk about democratic control of those things. Otherwise, you're not talking about socialism.
I found it interesting. I was reading a little bit about what a socialist society is, and the author was making a claim that America in some ways really is, because when you think about our healthcare system, a large chunk of our healthcare system, the VA, the Medicare and Medicaid systems, are in a sense a socialized system because they are the government, us, the people, owning a share of our healthcare system and providing care. So I don't know if you would agree with that assessment, but I found that interesting to think, there's probably some socialism already in existence. We just don't call it by that name.
Yeah, and I guess I'm torn in two directions there, because one thing I want to guard against or warn people against is this assumption that if government's in charge, it's socialism. So a lot of people think that socialism means big government makes all the decisions. And so when they look at what was called the Soviet Russia, but was not Soviet in any way, was not socialist in any way, they say, oh yeah, look at Stalin and all those other people, big government controlling everything. That is not socialism. That is just another example of a small minority of people making decisions about how the means of production are going to be used. So yes, the U.S. government is in charge of a sizable amount of our healthcare system, but is there democratic decision making that determines how that health gets administered? That I don't know. I don't have a good answer to that.
So maybe you can give us an example of a sort of an aha moment that you've seen students have in your classroom, something that they might have taken for granted, an assumption that you were able to lead them to look at more closely.
Sometimes when we read some pages from Karl Marx, students will see that, at least according to Marx, they may or may not end up accepting his view in the end, but they see that they pay for the privilege to work. So most people think that when they work, they're getting paid. And they are getting paid. But according to Marx, they're not getting paid the full value of what they produce. So in a way, when you go to work for an employer, you're getting a wage, but you made all the value that goes into that wage over time. Obviously, it's not like every day that this happens, but so the wage that you're given is value that you yourself have created, and then there's more value that you've created, and that ultimately gets turned into profit, provided that the company is doing well. And so basically, you are being taxed for the privilege of working. And I think when students see that, they start to go, it's kind of weird. Hmm. That's kind of strange. And again, I'm presenting that as Marx's view. I myself am sympathetic to the idea. But yeah, if there are aha moments, it's stuff like that. And also some of Marx's remarks about how there are striking similarities between being a wage laborer and being a slave. There are these non-obvious similarities. Not to say that they're the same. He's not saying they're identical, but there are these strange similarities that just start to shift your orientation, how you view the world.
When you were saying that, it reminded me of being in a classroom with students, and we know that some work is valued much more highly than others in our economy. Mm-hmm. The CEO gets paid a lot more than the average worker, and I know there's research that shows that most of us would have a sense of how much more a CEO should make than an employee. And I had students sort of take a guess, decide what the employee should make and what the CEO. And it was exactly what the research showed, 6 or 7 times the average employee should be making. And yet when we looked at what the reality is in our economy, we saw that it was hundreds of times in many cases. And so I know from my own experience in the classroom, that was a real awakening moment for them to realize how much disparity there was between those things. Mm-hmm. So it sounds like you have some of those same experiences with your students, especially, I'm sure, when you talk about Karl Marx.
Yeah, and the students that I have here, so St. Xavier University has, as a majority of its students who are first in their families to go to college. These are first-generation students. I think we have upwards of maybe 60% first-generation students. And so if you're first in your family to go to college, it's not surprising to know that those families typically don't have lots of money. And so the students that I work with here at St. Xavier, they would see that difference in pay, and they go, there's something fishy going on there. That just doesn't seem fair. Whereas when I taught at Vanderbilt, I know for a fact, because I had these types of discussions in my class, that there would be students who just say, that CEO, the reason he's getting paid is because he's so valuable and there's nothing wrong with it. Yeah,
that's a very interesting comparison that you've taught in such different environments and you've seen students have such different reactions to the same kind of information.
Yeah.
Would you tell us a little bit about some of your core values today? As a professor, as someone who is, a few years under your belt now of teaching students, working with these first generation students here at this university, what would you really value?
One of the things that I try to do is not be so dismissive of the views of people I disagree with. That's not to say that I always succeed at doing that, but and there are times when I can come up with reasons, good reasons, why I disagree with a certain view, but I try to resist that temptation to feel as though I can make those people lose and I win or something like that. Because I don't think that, although I think there's something maybe natural to that inclination, at least maybe in the type of society we grow up in, perhaps. Although there might be something natural to it, it's not, being dismissive of people you disagree with is not going to do anything in the way of bringing about the kind of social change I would like to see. So, yeah, I don't know.
Well, so you're saying listening and at least trying to understand what someone who has a different view really has to say. I know I often hear people say, well, there's no point engaging with someone who has a really different perspective on an issue, because all you do is you dig in and you both defend your position and you don't get anywhere. It sounds like you would argue something different, that maybe just listening to the other person has some value.
Perhaps. I mean, I am of the opinion as well. I think that the view that you just expressed, I mean, my father and I do not agree on political issues, and for the most part, I try to just not talk about those things anymore. It used to be that I would bring them up and we'd get kind of a little testy towards each other. Yeah, and I guess one of the things that's so nice about the context of a college classroom is that the discussions that you have, it's not like you meet someone in a bar and you talk for 20 minutes or 30 minutes about issues, and it's just you and that person drawing upon whatever knowledge you have to make the various claims that you're making. In a college classroom, there are texts in front of you, and the idea is to try to make sense of what the texts are saying. And so you learn to listen when you engage in close reading of these, at least in philosophy, these often difficult texts. So yeah, listening is definitely important, but it's not easy to do. And my hope is that one of the things I'm able to accomplish in the courses I teach is to teach students to pay very close attention to what others are saying. You may in the end dismiss what they're saying, and I totally understand that. If you've had over and over again the experience of having the same type of conversation with people, my thinking often is, why talk with these people? I should go find the people I agree with, and we should build movements of some sort and transform society. That's not to say that that's exactly what I do with my life, but that's kind of my line of thinking. So as I see it, freedom is not just being able to do whatever you want within your kind of own sphere of your life or whatnot. Freedom is being able to participate in shaping the conditions that shape you. So there is no way getting around collective decision making, or there's no way of getting around, I should say, just working with other people. And so you have some people, and some of them, certain types of libertarians, who have this vision of the individual on his or her own kind of determining what's going to happen in their lives. And I think in the type of complex society we live in, freedom is to be achieved in a more kind of indirect way, and that's by shaping the conditions that shape you. Now, that means you don't have as much control as you might like, mm-hmm. But what it, I think, highlights is that you have to be very attentive to those things that are so influential in terms of shaping the conditions that shape us.
This is part one of a two-part show. Join us again next week to hear the conclusion of our conversation.
You've been listening to Your True North with Cindy Camp. The opinions expressed on today's episode are not necessarily those of WXAV 88.3 FM, St. Xavier University, or the producers of Your True North. For a copy of today's program, you can download it as a podcast by visiting yourtruenorthpodcasts.com. Thank you very much for listening to Your True North.